You missed the reading. Hi, my name is Keith, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July 15th, 2003. I don't say that to brag. I say that to let the newcomer know that it is possible to stay sober one day at a time. Tonight we're on 8 and 9. I'm going to combine them because I got a trip in a couple weeks, so. Plus, I get out of here quicker than drawing it out for a couple more weeks. But, so tonight we're getting into the meat and potatoes of this deal. Last week we talked about 6 and 7, which is the actual beginning of the meat and potatoes as far as transformation goes. And, it's awesome seeing faces that are here every week because, you know, friendly faces, and obviously it's easier for me because I get to see you guys and get to know you a little bit better. So thank you for you guys who keep showing up, and to the new people, thanks for coming out. Last week, I think I rambled on a little bit about some stuff that was cleansing for me. So if you didn't get anything out of that step 7, I apologize. But again, it was great for me to unload some of that stuff. So tonight we're going to be talking about 8 and 9, which is this amends process. Like, this is the what you hear read at a lot of meetings, the promises, right? And I'm going to start off by reading the promises, and I'm going to work my way back. Because I've said it before jokingly, but, you know, a lot of newcomers come in, and they think when they hear these promises, I don't know if they correlate it with what they're talking about as far as where in the process they're talking about them. You know, we come in beaten and broken, and, of course, 60 days in, when you've been abstinent for 60 days and you get a job, you get your car back, you get a girlfriend, and you think, wow, these are the promises, right? But that's not what they're talking about. So up until the promises, there's like a lot of work to be done. There's 83 pages of work, and it says something like this. It says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, meaning the 8th and 9th step, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in self-esteem and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do by ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. Some are being fulfilled sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But they will always materialize if we work for them. Now, when I read that, you know, talked about that feeling of uselessness and self-pity would disappear. When I got here, that didn't happen for me in the first 90 days. You know what I mean? That uselessness and self-pity. Like I said before, when I got here, I didn't jump right into this deal. I was 6 months abstinent in a halfway house, and I was just undrunk. You know what I mean? And it said self-seeking will slip away, right? So that tells me I'm selfish when I get here. So let's take this all the way back to the 3rd step, and I talked about it a couple weeks ago. Like, the 3rd step, when I get here, it means very little to me. Like, it's telling me to turn my will and my life over to care of guys that understood them. Well, I don't believe in God when I get here. I don't know what you're talking about, turning my will and something over to that. As I'm more, the more I'm sober, it's everything to me. Like, it is the most important thing I do on a daily basis. But let's see what they're talking about. Because remember, we're about to get ready to make some amends. And I talked about it a couple weeks ago. It's important that they get somebody totally different. So this is me. It says, selfishness, self-centered, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate. See, he's setting it up, right? That was me when I got here. Selfish, self-centered, it's all about me. So when I get here, I don't think I have resentments. I haven't done anything to anybody else. And I'm going to talk about those because, again, I can sit up here and read this book to you, but how does it correlate in my life? How do these steps work in my life? So I'm going to explain how I did these amends and what they meant to me, right? So I step on the toes of my fellows, my family, people like you, and you guys retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, a lot of times, seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past, I've made decisions based on self, which placed me in a position to be hurt. So here it is. I'm not a victim when I get here. I'm not going to recap, but if you were here, you know I talked about this all the time. I come in here a victim. It's your fault why my life sucks. But here it tells me right here. Page 62, if you guys have a highlighter, you want to know what I'm reading this from. It says, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. Though I usually don't think so. So now, let's jump forward back to this ninth step. So anybody who thinks of just coming in here and getting undrunk and that's the deal, I mean, you're missing the boat. I love how Stevie B says it. You know, we come in here, I come in here, I speak for myself. I come in here beaten and broken. I come to some meetings. I get undrunk, but I don't change, right? I know guys who don't believe in the big book. Like, they just think all we got to do is just don't drink no matter what. Just make your meetings and all that stuff. That wasn't me. That wasn't my truth. If I could just not drink no matter what, I wouldn't need to come here, right? I had to get down to causes and conditions. That's what my teachers taught me. Because the drinking and the drugs was just but a symptom. So in my fourth step and fifth step, I find out what those conditions are and what those causes are. I find out who you got when I showed up on the scene. And I'm a selfish, selfish person when I get here. So then it says this. This speaks to those people. And again, I'm not devaluing meetings. I'm not saying meeting makers make it is a bad thing. I'm not putting that down. Before I would tell you you're crazy for doing that, but that's not my job to say that today. But right. So if I think just getting undrunk and coming in here is going to fix it, this is what it says about that. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say the only thing he needs to do is keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there would be no home if he doesn't. But he's yet a long way from making good to the wife or the parents for whom years he has been shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience of mothers, wives who've had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, or we'd perhaps be dead. Now listen to this. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. See if you can relate to that. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man or woman is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. Right? So that's telling me that just by me coming in here getting AA, that's not enough. You know, I got to go back and take care of what I've done in the past. So let's talk about some of these amends that I had to make. You know, I come in here, I do the work, you know, I got a good sponsor. When I finally made the decision, I'm finally going to do this deal, like I'm going to take it on. Because for 6 months, I didn't take this thing on. For 6 months, I came in, I hung out, I went to meetings. I went to some meetings where they had open speaker meetings, like, you know, speaker disgusting meetings and stuff. And it was all about the people out there, right? I'm looking at the girls. I'm not listening. I'm not buying in any of this stuff. And then 6 months into the deal, I had this shift where I took this thing on. And so I do the step work and stuff, and now I'm 10 months sober, right? And again, I think that during my drinking and drugging career, because I drank and drugged for 20 years, right? From 15 to 35, I was doing drugs and drinking. And then along the way, I had some geographical cures. I had the Marine Corps, all this stuff, right? Thinking that was going to fix me. So the last 10 years of my drinking, my family had no idea where I was, right? None. And during this time, I'm telling myself, like, I'm not hurting anybody but myself, right? It's just me. I'm hurting, you know what I mean? This is my life. I'm not hurting anybody. But when I saw my mother for the first time in 7 years, because this lady, if you've been here, you heard the story, who called her at 3 a.m, when I saw her, last time I saw her, she had black hair, she was vibrant, she was beautiful. She comes down to Florida, she's got gray hair, you know what I mean? She got wrinkles and stuff, and I find out later this woman worried about me for 7 years because she didn't know if I was dead or alive or not. So when they talk about selfish self-centeredness, even though I'm not there and there and I'm like in her face, by me not being there for those 7 years and not calling her and warning her, like I held her emotions hostage. Like for a mother, that's the worst, you know what I mean? To know if your son's out alive or dead or whatever. So that was my first amends I had to make, her and my family. So I'm 10 months sober after doing the deal. I'm at a sober house. You know, I got my list, so to speak, from the fourth step. And again, this is where good sponsorship comes from. Because it talks about, people said we made a list. or we make a list. You don't make a list. The list is already made in your four-step inventory. And I said it before. When you do your four-step, don't burn it. Don't throw it away. Don't put it out to sea. None of that shit. You got the four-step is the blueprint for the rest of the work. So I got this four-step inventory, and I got my list. And so 10 months into the deal, you know, Joe puts me on a plane back to New York. And I told this story a couple weeks ago. For me, flying home, I had a stopover in Charlotte. And this was the first time in my recovery that I wasn't protected by the sober house. Like, I was out of the state of Florida. But I wasn't home yet. So I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I'm in this airport. And I'm starting to make up stuff in my head about this amends I'm about to make. Starting to get fearful. I'm sitting in the bar. And for me, that was a lot. For me, flying, that was my a major spot to drink on your layovers. Like, I go into the airport. I'm hoping the plane lays over for 6 hours, but that's enough time to get nice and zooted. But I'm sitting in this bar, and I'm going back and forth, and I'm like, nobody. I'm looking around because, you know, I don't know who's here. You know what I mean? Somebody from Florida might see me, you know. I see the beer getting poured. I see the shots being poured, and I'm thinking, man, I just need one to take the edge off. Nobody will know. You know, I go buy some Altoids after this. I'm going home. They don't know. I'm going home. I'm sober. Florida won't know because I'm going to New York. I'm just mental, you know the word. And I don't know. I had a moment of clarity there for a minute. And I prayed to God. I just said, man, please remove this thought. Like, I don't want to live that way anymore. And he did. You know what I mean? The thought was gone right then and there. And that was the first tangible evidence of this thing called God that I saw for me. So I get on the plane, I go home. My mom picks me up, right? So now she knows where I've been for 10 months because I talk to her like every week. And so the whole family's asking her, you know, when she came down, what's up with Keith? And, you know, mom's lying to him and stuff. And she didn't want to tell him for 7 years I was out there doing drugs and everything. And so now it's time for me to take care of this. And we get in my mom's car and we drive around the city. Rochester, it's not New York City, James. It's upstate New York. It's like Western New York. Farmland. Farmland, so to speak. And I get all my family at my grandmother's house. And mind you, now, that morning, I prayed with Joe. And like it says, you know, you want to go in with a game plan, right? I want to go in knowing what I'm about to do, what I'm about to say. Like, I want to have it planned out, like what I'm about to do. And so me and Joe prayed that morning, and he gave me some good advice on what I was going to say. And I'm making up in my head what's going to happen here. Because, like, my mom, I know she's going to forgive me because she's my mother, of course. But these other people, like, you know, I always lived in fear of people, how they viewed you. You know what I mean? Like, people pleasing and stuff. But this is my family, so why do I care what they think? I mean, they're going to love me regardless. But that wasn't the case. You know what I mean? In my head, I'm like, I can't tell these people this. I'm 35. I'm the oldest grandson. I'm supposed to be a success and all this crap. And I'm just in my head. And me and Joe prayed about it. So I get into my grandmother's house, and they're all sitting there, and I walk out, and you know, I tell them, like, this is why I got you out here. You know what I mean? I'm about to tell you where I've been for the last 7 years. You guys had questions for my mom, but I'm here to tell you everything. And I basically did a mini fist up with these people, right? And I bared my soul to them. Like, most of them, some of my aunts didn't know I did cocaine. Some of them didn't know I drank. Some didn't know I had DUI. Some didn't know I was arrested. I told them everything. And when I was done, right, it wasn't like, a white light experience. But for the first time in 35 years, my whole family knew who I was for the first time, which is pretty cool. So I repaired all those relationships. So I come back to Florida, right, and again, I talked about it before. I'm in this halfway house record. 4 years I was there. And so I'm at this halfway house for 4 years, and during this time, I come in, when I came to AA, I had nothing, literally nothing, right? I didn't have a bank account, I didn't have relationships with people, I didn't have a God, anything. So that 10 months in, I did that amends. I got a little job making $8 an hour, I got a little bank account, right? So I'm saving money, I'm paying down my rent on my own, because I owed the halfway house thousands of dollars, which we never let that happen again, but this is all me. It's all me taking care of my past. And so, but I, you know, the book talks about being reborn in freedom, right? And here I am sober, and I'm in Florida, But I have a warrant for my arrest, right? In Georgia. So every time I'm out and about in the streets, like I'm not driving, but if somebody I'm with is driving, we get pulled over, I'm like crapping my pants. I'm like, I'm about to go to jail. If I'm in a restaurant eating with some friends after an AA meeting, the cop walks in because they're coming to get dinner, I'm dipping out the back door because I'm thinking they're coming to get me. Like that's not, you know what I mean? That's not real freedom. That's not sober behavior either. And here I am sponsoring guys and I'm telling them, you know, you gotta do this, you gotta do that. Faith without works is dead and all this crap. And I still got that hanging over my head. And that's just not a way to live in sobriety. So 4 years into the deal, you know, I got my money saved and stuff. And Joe says, it's time. I go, it's time for what? And he's like, remember, we talked about faith without works is dead. I'm like, of course. He goes, remember Andy linked it for Victor of alcohol? I'm like, of course. Well, he's like, it's time. I go, it's time for what? He goes, it's time to go back to Georgia. And my mouth dropped, right? Because I hadn't told him anything about the license, you know what I mean? I hadn't told him the truth, but he knew, because there's a reason why I'm walking around here 4 years without a license and stuff. And I don't know how he found out about the Georgia warrant or whatever, but he knew. And he goes, it's time. And I'm like, Joe, I said, can I just do this? I work right around the corner. I don't, you know what I mean? I don't need my license. I'm good. He's like, no, Keith, you're not totally free. And, you know, it's not who you say you want. You know what I mean? And he goes, what about this God thing you have? You know, has God dropped you so far? And I'm like, no, he hasn't. You know what I mean? This is after all I've been through with the Calvary thing. And I see God working in my life daily, but here I am taking my will back and not trusting the process. Because again, fear, 100 forms of fear. So in my head, I'm a lawyer now, and I got it made up in my head that 3 DUIs in the state of Georgia, because they don't like blacks in Georgia, I'm going to get 20 years in prison for this 3rd DUI. But I'm trusting Joy, I'm trusting the process. So I said, okay. So now here's how God works again in my life. Because at this time, when I left Georgia, I had no family in Georgia. Now I got my brothers there, my sisters there, and my cousins are there. So I call my cousin, who's a social worker, and she knows this lawyer who has DUI cases. So I call him, and he tells me it's going to be $2,500. I don't have that, but he's going to take payments from me. Now, I don't know how many lawyers you know, but they don't take payments. You got to have the whole kit and caboodle before they even talk to you. So I'm like, cool. So I sent this guy $100 every month. I finally get him paid off, and then he calls the judge, and they get me a trial. Now, when this happens, I'm like, that's done, but I still haven't got my plane ticket yet. You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, I paid him off, Joe, and I think he's going to forget about it. He's like, no. Now, where's the ticket at? So I get the ticket. So before I go, I talk to my lawyer, and I tell him, you know, what's up, and I tell him my story, basically, and how I'm in a halfway house, I'm sober, and, you know, I got to come make these amends, and it's part of the step process, and he don't know what I'm talking about. He just knows that it's admirable that I want to turn myself in. I'm like, no, it's not admirable, bro. It's like, I wouldn't be doing this, but I got to do it for my sobriety. He's like, okay, whatever. So Joe, and this is why I love this man, because, again, he didn't have to do this, but what he did was he flew up to Georgia with me, right? Took time off, and he's been working at the time, took his business time off from his business to fly up there with me. I got letters from everybody in the AA community. My God is amazing, because my first boss, well, my boss now is my first sponsor, right? Now, I don't know how much time I'm going to get. I don't know what's going to happen in Georgia, but I go to my boss, and I tell him the truth. Like, listen, this is why I can't make deliveries for the company. And I told him the truth and stuff, and he's like, man. And I said, I got to go turn myself in, and I don't know what's going to happen. He's like, well, your job's going to be waiting here for you when you get back. Regardless of if it's 6 months or a year, your job's going to be here. I promise you that. So that blew me away, right? So I go to Georgia. Me and Joe fly up there. Now I'm at my cousin's house. Come to find out, my mom had no idea I was doing these amends in Georgia. She's down visiting my aunt, who's 88 years old, at the same time. So I'm blown away by that. So we have like this big feast at my cousin's house, and I'm telling them now why I'm in Georgia. They had no idea. And it feels pretty cool. Like, I don't have to pretend anymore in front of people. You know what I mean? Like, and that's one of these things that AA does for me. Like, I don't have to pretend. Like, I don't have to wear a mask anymore. I don't care what it looks like to you people or anybody out there. I can be me and it's all right. You know what I mean? So I'm telling my people this stuff and they're just like, man, I don't know who you are because O'Keefe wouldn't do what you're doing tomorrow morning. I'm like, I know, right? So we have this feast and we go to bed that night. We get up the next morning bright and early. Me and Joe get up early and we go out back and we're just sitting there talking and then we say a prayer together and, you know, I forget exactly how the prayer went, but it was something like, let your will be done. Whatever happens, let Keith handle it with dignity and whatever he said. And it was so calming, right? So we go to court and I went and bought a brand new 3-piece suit, some penny loafers and stuff. I'm decked out to the hills, right? And I get to court. And if you got a lawyer, they usually call those guys first, right? So I go to court and there's front row full of orange suits and stuff. And they call my name first. And so I go up in front of the judge and my lawyer has all these letters already. So he's already tried to make a deal with the prosecution, but they don't want to hear it. The prosecution like, no, sir. So the judge calls me up to the front and he's like, Mr. Neal, how are you? I'm like, fine. He's like, where you been for the last 7 years? And I'm like, hey, I have to do some more research and develop, Your Honor. You know what I mean? And so he looks at the charges. He read off all my charges. I had like 5 charges, like DUI, driving without a license, no insurance, unregistered vehicle. The vehicle I was driving was stolen in the lines of the law because it didn't have any plates or anything on it. So I had like 5 charges. And the judge looks at the prosecution and goes, what do you want to give Mr. Neal? And the judge, they were like, you know, I think 2 years, something ridiculous. Like it was, I forget exactly what they said, but it was totally, like my mouth dropped when I heard them say what they wanted to give me. And the judge looked at the prosecution and he looked at me and he says, no. Right? And I'm like, whoa. And he looks at the prosecution and he looks at me and he looks at the judge and my defense attorney and he goes, Mr. Neal, I commend you for turning your life around. And he looks at the prosecution and he goes, look, I'm not giving him nothing of what you just said. I'm going to give this man 30 days. So it's really 15 in Georgia, like 2 for 1 or whatever. And I already did 3. I'm going to give him a $2,000 fine and 2 years probation. Right? And I'm looking like, oh, this is awesome. So I look at my mom, and she's back there crying. She thought I got like 20 years or something because she's like going crazy. And I looked at her, and I go, Mom, it's going to be all right. You know, I'm good. So I gave her my phone and my wallet and stuff, and they take me in the back. Now, mind you, for the first time in, 7 years, I don't have a warrant for my arrest. Like, I'm a free man, basically. But I'm not thinking that at the time, but I'm just trying to lay the story out for you. So I go back in the back, and I'm in the back, and I'm in jail for a couple days, and they put me in the cell. And down in Georgia, they have this where it's, you have upper lower levels and stuff. So you get free time, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, whatever. And you can smoke in there and stuff. And so I'm in there with these two little jits, and I'm bonding with these guys, you know what I mean? Like, I'm in there with these guys, and I'm basically living with them. So, you know, we're playing spades, we're playing chess, and commissary comes, we're dividing our little roll-up cigarettes and eating honey buns, and I mean, we're just bonding, like, we're brothers and stuff, right? So we're sitting in jail one night, and they start talking about why they're in there. I'm like, oh, shit. So one guy's like, yeah, I'm in here for attempted murder. You know what I mean? Why are you in here? He's like, oh, I'm in here for selling a key of cocaine to an undercover cop. You know, they're like giving dap and shit. They're like bragging about this, right? And they look at me, Neal, what you in here for? And I'm like, a DUI from 2000. They're like, what? They came and got you? It's like, nah. I turned myself in. Like, they just stopped what they were doing, looked at me like, you did what? I said, I turned myself in. Why would you do that? So I started talking a little bit about the program, right? Not much, you know what I mean? But I basically tell them that I had to do this to be free. And I was like, you know, it's part of this deal that I'm in, and part of the process is you got to come up and clean the records of your past. And this is being my records of my past. I had to turn myself in, and they just looked at me like I was crazy. And then I was like, listen. I said, for the first time in 7 years, like I just told you, I said, I'm a free man. And they both looked at me with a puzzled look on their face. I go, what the hell are you talking about? Free. You're locked up. You're eating honey buns. You're playing spades. We're watching Cops on Saturday night. Shit, you ain't free. And I'm like, listen. I said, for the first time in 7 years, I'm not looking over my shoulders anymore. I said, I'm a free man. And they got what I was saying. So I'm in there for the next 10 days and, you know, I don't preach program anymore, but if they want to talk about it, we talk about it. So they're asking me questions about the halfway house and all this and that and my drug history and all that stuff. So I we did that. So I get out and I come back to Florida. And when I come back, man, it's, and in my head, I'm like, okay, so now I can get my license back because I turned myself in. But the laws got, it's different because the time don't start until you take care of what you got to take care of and shit. So now I got to wait another 5 years from 2007 to 2012 to get my license back. But I talked about it before. My God, man, he looked out for me in a way with my job. Like, every job I got was in walking distance of where I lived at. And I had people in my life that they would come and get me. Like, I hate asking for rides, but they came and got me. So I talk about this selfish, self-centeredness behavior, right? I'm going to talk about my father now. My dad, I didn't know him. I seen him. You know, I got stepbrothers and sisters. We got the same father, different mothers. My dad, I would see at my grandmother's house, his mother's house, with his new family, with his wife and his new wife and my sisters and brothers or whatever. And then every time I saw him, until I was 16, it was, you know, it wasn't like, hey, dad. No, it was like a uncle or something. So on my 16th birthday, he came to the house with my step-siblings and stuff. And he said to me, hey, let's go to my house for dinner. I'm like, for what? He's like, I want to talk to you. Because this whole time, I didn't know that knew about me. And we had a conversation that night, and he told me the whole story about why he wasn't in my life and all this stuff. And I'm like, whatever. So that happened. So 2 years go by, and I'm living in Rochester, and I'm drinking, I'm drugging, life is going nowhere. And he says, come live with me. So I go live with him and his other family. Now, for these next 2 years, I'm holding my dad emotional hostage again. Like, I'm throwing in his face that he wasn't there growing up, and it's his fault why my life sucks and all this stuff, right? And for 2 years, he felt the guilt, and I could get anything I want from this man. And I knew what I was doing. So about 3 years into the deal, he gets tired of that. And I come home one night drunk as a skunk, and he'd had enough. And he's waiting up for me, and I come in, and he's like, listen. He's like, I can't do it anymore. You know what I mean? Because I know what you're doing, and I think I paid the price. I think now, you know, it's time for either you to go to school, join the Marine Corps, or get out. Well, I didn't want to get out because I had nowhere to go. I didn't want to go to school because that would have been a waste of his money. And I'm like, the Marine Corps, where the hell did he get that from? He don't know nobody in the Marine Corps. I'm like, I chose the Marines because I'm thinking he's just full of shit about that. 2 hours later, there's a drill sergeant knocking on the door, Saturday morning. And he signs me up for the Marine that morning. So I go off to the Marine Corps and, you know, during this time, you know, it's the relationship is better, but it isn't like what it could be. So I go off to the Marine Corps, and this is back in 1990. When I got out of boot camp, Saddam decides to invade Iraq. And I go from boot camp to Desert Storm. Now, I wasn't here in the States, but if you were here, you knew that whole war was fought on CNN. Like, it was on the things. And my dad told me this story like a couple years ago. But this man started feeling guilty that I was over in war. Like, he thought he was going to lose his son because of his decision he made. And I never knew he felt that way because, you know, it was the best move he could have ever done for me. So I get sober, and, you know, I'm getting sober, and we have this conversation. Like, I did the steps at Unity, and he heard the steps I did last time because of Rachel putting this on rocket.org. And he hears this part of my story. And so he calls me up one day after doing that, and he just started crying, and I'm like, what's up, Pop? And he's like, listen, I want to tell you how proud I am of you. And I'm like, for what? He goes, for the man you become and what you're doing with your life and stuff. And he goes, you talked about that, me making you go to the Marine Corps. And he goes, it brought me back to the war and you being over there and me watching the war on CNN. And he goes, I want to tell you, man, I cried every night that you were over there. He's like, I blame myself for you being there. And we're not crying in our family, you know what I mean? So for him to tell me that and break down, you know, it almost brought tears in my eyes, but I don't cry. So I was just like, whoa, you know what I mean? Pop, chill out. You know what I mean? Like, it's all good. I go, that was the best thing you could have ever done for me. And I told him, you know, I made my amends to him that day. Like, I had never really sat down and made amends for taking him hostage for those 3 years, but since he got open and honest with me and vulnerable with me, it gave me permission to do that with him. Not the way you're supposed to do an amends, but that's how we did ours for this one. And it was the first intimate conversation I could think of between my father, where it gave me permission to tell him how I really felt, not just that I was wrong for doing that for 3 years or whatever. And when that happened, our relationship today is like nothing like it's ever been before. You know what I mean? Like, this is what's possible from this process. Like, I'm amazed by that. So now I'm repaired with my family, my mother, my father, my stepbrother, the one who came, wanted us to go over there. He's an officer in Atlanta now, right? Again, God is amazing. So he lives in Atlanta. I'm going back to get this license thing in 2012. All my fines are paid, everything's done. I deserve my license back because that's who I, you know what I mean? I'm sober, I deserve my license back. You guys need to give me my license because I'm sober. I call my brother up and I say, hey, I need to come to Atlanta, take care of this license thing, can I stay with you? Yeah, come on. So I go there. I'm thinking I'm just going to walk into the DMV, give them some money, and I'm going to get my license back. They had a different idea, you know what I mean? He's a cop, so he wears his uniform to get me in and out of places and stuff. And I got ran around, like going from West Palm to Miami this whole day. The lady wants to send me away. She's like, she's just nasty about it. And I don't know where this came from, but I was very calm that day. Like, it was like, I knew God was there because normally I would have lost him. I'm like, you're effing and you got to be kidding me and don't you understand? But none of that happened. Officer Griffin over here, different story. He's like, James, he's like, you mother, you know, he's just going off. And I'm looking at him and he's looking at me. He's like, why aren't you getting upset? This is fine. And I'm like, bro, it's all good. I mean, I've waited this long. What's another week or whatever? You know what I mean? And I tell that story because, number one, God is, like, I sent him before me that morning. Like, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. But my brother, me and him, our relationship is fixed now to the point where when they came to Georgia, when I left Georgia to come to Florida, you know, I was living in Georgia and they were coming to move there to go to college. So they talked to me, we'll be there next Friday. When they come, I'm gone on my last geographical trip to Florida. And for 7 years, they didn't know if I was dead or alive. So here I am talking to him now, years later, and he is instrumental in me getting my license back, right? So me and him start having conversations about this thing called recovery. We got lots of family members in the deal, you know, that are drunk and they need help, whatever. So I'm explaining to him what's going on and I tell him everything, right? And he's just asking me questions and stuff, and I'm telling him this stuff and it's he's just blown away by it. So, you know, we had this halfway house. And him and his wife came down to visit us. And, you know, he went to Joe. And he don't know anything about the God thing. He just knows that Joe was the one who helped me get sober. He don't understand that Joe put my hands in God's hands and get sober. So he's giving Joe all the praise and stuff. Which I ain't going to, you know what I mean? I ain't going to burst his bubble or whatever. But I'm sitting back watching this. And I'm amazed at what God has done. So he does that. We have this website for solutions or whatever. And we get people to send testimonies in. Or people send testimonies in. And so this mother sent a testimony for her son. And me not knowing this, my brother sent Joe a letter, right? And Joe put this on the website without telling me. So I'm looking at the website one day. And if you go on there, you can see it. And just so you know, I'm not blowing smoke. But when I read it, the things he said, like, he was giving me and Joe credit for this life we have today. Not knowing that it's it's all God, right? It's all, because he's not a religious person and stuff, and I'm not a religious person, but I know the truth. And if you read this letter, man, it just blows me away. Amends are not I'm sorry's, right? It's not I'm sorry. It's me repairing old relationships. It's me making amends for the wrongs I committed and rebuilding relationships. So now, him, my father, my mother, my extended family in New York, we're all good. There's one more to go. There's my sister, my stepsister. I got her down here, and I told her everything that happened and, you know, where I'd been and stuff, and of course she forgave me and stuff. She's a teacher in D.C. So just recently she was down here, but she's making plans to come to Florida for a vacation. Now, mind you, before, she would never come to want to stay with me because she knows Keith was into coke and alcohol and drugs and no license, and she was just afraid to be around me. But she calls me up, and she says, I'm coming down for 5 days, and where's a good place to stay at? And I'm like, here in Delray with me, you know what I mean? Like, Tia Verde, Hotel Casa Neal, and that would have never happened before I got sober. And so she came down here, and we had, like, the best time ever. The reason why I tell you these stories is because this is what's possible. This is what recovery does, right? I have new relationships with everybody that is in my family. The old Keith that they knew is dead and gone, right? You've heard me say it, if you've been coming here, that I've been able to live two lifetimes in one life. Well, that's the same with my family. We've been able to have two relationships in this lifetime. The first one was whenever they saw the phone ring with my name on it, they knew I wanted something. They knew I needed something. They knew I was in trouble. Now, it's when they see my phone number, I don't want nothing. They know I don't want anything. I'm just calling to see how you're doing. What's up? What can I do for you? You know what I mean? It was never that way before I got sober. And I love how Stevie B says it. Like, we come in here, and you go to a buffet or whatever, and he says something like, you go to a buffet, and you go to the buffet, and the buffet's got prime rib and lobster tails and roast beef and all this stuff, but we want to go there and just get the salad bar. You know, we just want to get the croutons. Equating that to this thing called recovery, I want to come in here, right? Of course, we all want to come in here beaten and broken. I'll speak for myself. I came in here beaten and broken, right? And when I came in here, my intention was not what I have today. It was just to learn how to drink, you know what I mean? Learn how to survive or whatever. But it wasn't really this whole deal. And a lot of times people come in and they shortchange themselves because what's possible is amazing. I don't have a lot of money. I'm not poor either. I don't have a lot of money. I don't have the nicest car. I don't have the nicest house. But all my needs are met. You know what I'm saying? And they talked about peace and serenity. I didn't have that when I got here. They talked about usefulness. I didn't have that when I got here. My life was of no purpose. Like, I wanted to die when I got here. Today I have a relationship with a God of my understanding. Let me repeat that. A God of my understanding. So if you're new and you hear that word God and you get afraid, you know what I mean? There's nothing to be scared of. All you're going to do is get a God of your understanding. It's not your parents' God. It's not your sponsor's God. It's not my God. It's not. It's your own relationship. The only thing you got to do is seek that relationship, right? If that scares you, oh well. Your misery can be refunded to you. But before I did this work and before I got this relationship with God and my understanding, none of this was possible. It just wasn't. It wasn't going to happen. I'm living today a life today that was not going to happen, left on my own devices. Given who I was when I got here, none of this is possible. My parents wouldn't have forgave me. My brothers wouldn't have forgave me. You know, they would have got the same old, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I'm sorry means I'm setting you up to do it again. You know what I'm talking about. I'm sorry. I know somebody makes them into me. If they come with me, I'm sorry. What are you sorry for? You know what I mean? This life I live today is one of immense grace. And if you're here last week, you hear me talking about what I'm going through with somebody near and dear to me, right? That's his journey. Somebody else near in our family is going through some stuff right now, and, you know, he might die from this thing. All because he refuses to surrender. All because he wants to remain the same, like I did that exercise. He wants to mix something over something new. Like, here's what he says. Right now, he's in Fort Lauderdale Hospital. His father drove all the way down from Philadelphia down to Fort Lauderdale. Because he just don't know. His father has no idea. His father lost his son to this disease 2 years ago, right? Guy was 27 years old. He OD'd on heroin. So now his younger son is 22 years old. And he thinks he can save that guy. So he gets in the car and he drives all the way down here. And the son's telling him all this stuff. And me and Allie are sitting back and we know the truth. You know what I'm saying? We know that he's running on his father. Like, this guy is lying so good. Well, not so good, but he tells his father this on a, on a 4th of July Eve. Dad, I'm going down to Bal Harbor with some AA friends. On the tri-rail. He says, because the dude told us this story, and I just started laughing, like, seriously, bro. He says he was riding the tri-rail down south, and a tree fell and hit the tri-rail, the train, and hit the conductor in the head. They had to get off the tri-rail and get on another tri-rail. And I'm just sitting there listening, like, seriously? And the father is believing it because he's telling me and Allie, it'll be on the news later. It'll be on the news later, right? And I'm like, dude, you're out of your mind. But I get it because he's a father. My mom, you know, would do anything. So Friday comes, and he wants to go back out, and he's trying to tell stories, and his father's not believing it. For the first time, he's like, no, you're going to stay here with me. And the son, and I believe this was God, because the son, for the first time in a year and a half, came out and told the truth. Like, Dad, I'm going to die tonight if I don't get heroin. He's like, I've been lying to you for the last year and a half. So now he's in Fort Lauderdale Hospital as we speak. So his dad wants us to talk to him, and his dad doesn't know anything about recovery. He's saying things like the guy is the captain of his own vessel, and it's up to him and all this stuff. And I'm just sitting there like, listen, your son might die. You know what I mean? Your son might die. And it's not up to him. Only thing he can do is surrender. I didn't preach the God thing to him. But that's the reality that we live with right here. You know what I mean? This thing wants me dead. And it would tell me a lie, and I would believe that lie and pick it up. And I believe that, I mean, he's not a bad kid. I know right where he's talking about. I know right the lie he was telling his dad about the tri-rail estate. I did that for years. You know what I mean? Told my mom all kinds of lies and shit. Sounded good when I was telling her. You know, we talk about it now, it's like crazy. Like, I took her a bottle of Bacardi back in the day, and I would, this is how stupid I am, but I'm thinking I'm getting over on her. Clear Bacardi, I'm drinking her bottle of Bacardi, and I'm putting water back in the bottle, put it back up to the line where she had it, right? So when she goes to make herself a cocktail, it's water. Keith, where's my liquor? I don't know what you're talking about, Mom. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I did. I say all that to say this, man. If you're in treatment, or if you're in a halfway house, or if you're new, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what happened in the past. It don't matter if you got 15 white chips. It doesn't matter. What matters is today and right now. Ask yourself this. What is it that you want, and how committed are you to having that? You know what I mean? Like, right now, the beautiful thing about recovery is this. If you've been slacking, if you've been just hanging out, hanging in there, if you've just been not doing nothing for your recovery, you can recommit right now. You can leave this meeting right now and recommit. Call your sponsor. Hey, I want to get in the book. Do whatever, but you can recommit right now. I'm not unique. I'm not better than anybody sitting in this room. I'm just a little bit more surrendered than some. The way Joe used to tell me, he's like, if you knew what I knew about you, you'd be excited as hell. And I never knew what the hell he was talking about. Right? I never knew what he was saying when he said that to me. I didn't know about this God thing, because when he talked about God, I'm like, oh my God, another one of these bleeding deacons. Another one of these bleeding deacons. God, 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 please. I know God. I know God. Yes, I do know him today. And the cool thing about it is this. Like, if you don't have to believe a word I'm telling you up here. Check it in the book. I read from the book. But I know this. I know 11 years ago, come next Tuesday, when I walked in here, I was dying. Didn't want to live. Weighed 140 pounds. Didn't have a bank account. Didn't have relationships with my mother, my father. Didn't have nothing. The book talks about all your scorecards reading zero. 11 years ago, coming this Tuesday, that was my life. Left to my own devices, I couldn't be up here standing in front of you telling you my story. Only by the grace of God. You know what I mean? Because I should be dead right now or incarcerated. So God does do amazing, wonderful things in my life. And God willing, I'll be here tomorrow, sober, and he's here for all of us. So with that, I'm going to close, and God bless.